and welcome to LSTM's podcast series, where we meet some of the most curious minds in science. I'm Lee Bowman, and today we'll be catching up with Dr. Philip McCall, who will be discussing the threat posed by dengue, the world's most widespread arbovirus, and Dr. Jacob Riveron, who talks about his research into gene expression in the insect model Drosophila melanogaster. First up, we have Chris Spencer and Dr. Philip McCall.
Today I'm here with Dr. Philip McCall, who's the reader in medical entomology here at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Hi, Philip.
Hello.
I thought we'd focus on dengue today, so I wonder if you can explain that, as dengue is such a global disease, why is it not receiving the same level of attention as diseases such as malaria?
Probably for a number of reasons. First of all, dengue is relatively new in comparison to malaria, certainly in terms of its global distribution and in the frequency of dengue outbreaks. Dengue has been around for a long time, but really became prominent in the later part of the 20th century. It spread worldwide very rapidly in the modern era as populations have increased, as the size of the cities and urban zones in countries worldwide has also grown at an incredible rate in the last 30 years. But with the level of global travel today being as it is, then the movement of dengue-infected individuals from one continent to another is that much easier. So today there are four different serotypes of dengue, and all four serotypes can be found today in all continents worldwide.
Okay, so is the increased incidence of dengue entirely due to human population movements, or are there any other driving factors?
It's not just movements, but it's also the size of our cities today, which are so enormous that the kind of measures we might have used successfully, let's say 30, 40 years ago, to control dengue vectors, they're just not going to work today. You asked about dengue in relation to malaria. Malaria has been recognised for a very long time as being a major cause of mortality, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. Dengue, on the other hand, the mortality rate of dengue is never as high as it is with malaria. But the biggest problem with dengue is that in an outbreak, the numbers of cases can be enormous. You get these explosive outbreaks. So the burden from dengue is not simply that it kills people, but the drain it puts on the health systems in the countries and the resources it draws away from other diseases during periods of outbreaks, this is where the burden lies.
Okay, so in terms of these explosive outbreaks, are we likely to get any viral emergences in places we've never had dengue before?
Yeah, this is a source of great concern. Dengue has clearly been spreading. The reasons it has spread so rapidly in the last 30 years are, as they say, travel and population issues. But in the modern era also, one of the mosquito vectors of dengue has also spread worldwide from its origin in Asia, and that represents a threat. So this mosquito, Aedes albopictus, or something called the Asian tiger mosquito, has spread to Africa, the Mediterranean, couple of parts of Europe, and has spread very rapidly throughout Latin America and even North America. And this is capable of transmitting dengue in areas where dengue would not have existed before. But although climate change is not believed to have been responsible to date for the spread of dengue, in the future, certainly, should temperatures rise at certain times of the year, at least in northern and southern latitudes, then potentially dengue could become certainly transmitted there for during those hot periods of the year and potentially established in some zones.
So what are we going to have to do about it? How do we counter the threat?
Well, I wish I could say that there were tools available to target dengue, but unfortunately, again, one of the reasons why it spread has been so difficult to slow or to prevent is that, first of all, there's no vaccine for dengue. There have been some there's some good progress in recent years in testing vaccines, but as of yet there are no vaccines available which are likely to become used widely in the near future. For that reason, we depend upon vector control, and vector control, although there are some tools available, there's some things one can do to prevent mosquitoes entering housing, to reduce biting and to suppress the vector populations. None of them yet really have proven to be sustainable in the, again, in the large cities where these kinds of interventions are needed. So there are no quick and simple solutions, even with heavy investment. There's nothing one can say, this is how one prevents dengue at present.
In that respect, what kind of thing are you currently researching, and how do you think that's going to affect the global burden?
Well, one of the things we're working on right now within the IDEMS consortium, which is a research consortium of a number of international partners worldwide, we're trying to develop dengue warning systems. So we're looking at a whole range of parameters, such as appearance of new dengue serotypes, changes in vector populations, increases in vector populations. The vector populations may themselves be responding to climatic events, so changes in temperature, increases in rainfall. Whether we can use parameters like this to warn or provide warnings well in advance of the vector population increasing in size and dengue transmission occurring, so that we can know far enough in advance of an outbreak that the threat is there, and then mount an operation to prevent the outbreak occurring, or perhaps just reduce the magnitude of the outbreak. The second thing we're doing is then looking at how one manages the outbreak. So we're looking at the options available for vector control, what kind of tools would be the best tools to use, which are the most effective methods for actually, killing adult dengue vectors or reducing the population and ultimately reducing transmission. Which of these are most likely to be cost effective, and which would be affordable for the nations where this work needs to be done. And also, obviously, the issue of sustainability is important. One can mount a hugely expensive response, but to do this time and time again is rarely feasible, so cost effectiveness is very important here. The second thing that we're doing here is we're trying to develop new tools. So to do this, we're looking at fundamental behaviour of the vector, looking at how it moves, where it rests, basic aspects of the natural history of these mosquitoes in the domestic environment, to see whether we can understand more about them and therefore find better places to target them by delivering insecticides, barriers, physical barriers, screens, nets and so on, with a view to finding a simple, sustainable solution for vector control.
Right, thank you very much for the interview then, Philip. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both Chris and Dr. McCall for the interview. Now we go to Kayla Barnes, who is speaking with Dr. Jacob Riveron.
This month we celebrate World Malaria Day. Malaria is still a huge burden in many, many countries and almost all developing countries. And vector control, specifically Anopheles mosquitoes, is one of the first lines of defense against malaria. Today I'm here with Dr. Jacob Riveron, who recently published a paper in Genome Biology. He's a research postdoc in the vector group, and he's going to tell us a little bit about that paper today.
Thanks, Kayla, for the invitation. First, I think that I have to say that the mosquito Anopheles funestus is one of the most important malaria vectors and has developed insecticide resistance in many parts of Africa. In this paper, we had used genetics, biochemistry, and structural experiments to detect the genes responsible for the metabolic resistance to the organochloride DDT. But more interestingly, we detect that one single mutation in this gene plays a key role in conferring metabolic resistance to DDT. We found that the glutathion S-transferase, epsilon 2, GST2, is the main gene involving DDT resistance, and we show also that this GST2 can metabolize the permethrin, the insecticide used in treated bed nets.
So this mutation has effects on a lot of different insecticides, so that's very worrying. But what is the function of the GST protein? in general?
Well, EST proteins are mainly related with the detoxifying. The traditional role that the scientific community has given to this family is to promote the water solubility by forming a complex between the insecticide and the glutathione before the excretion of the compound. But they have other functions, like in cell signaling, with implications in cancer development. But obviously, we are not focusing in this last part.
Yeah, fair. So, because it's only a single mutation, how did you find this mutation? And then how were you able to confirm that it causes resistance to DDT?
The populations of Anopheles funestus in Benin are 100% resistant to DDT, with no mortality after 1 hour of exposition to this compound. When we compare the sequence of this gene in the Benin population with other susceptible populations from Southern Africa, for example, we found that all the mosquitoes from Benin had one amino acid chain in a high conservative region close to the binding pocket. In this point of the study, we were wondering if this mutation could be involved in the high resistance to DDT observed in Benin. So, to answer this question, we analyzed the correlation between the genotype, mutation or no mutation, and the phenotype, resistant or susceptible mosquitoes to DDT, in a population from Cameroon, where we can find both haplotypes, with and without the mutation. And the correlation was really high. In summary, the percentage of mosquitoes that survived the DDT test was so much higher in the case of mosquitoes with the mutation in homozygotes than the mosquitoes that don't have any copy of the gene with the mutation. So we showed that the mutation is key to confer resistance to DDT. But to confirm this point, we carry out metabolism assays. And we show it that the protein with the amino acid chain is 3.4 times more efficient at metabolizing DDT.
So just to recap, you found that in the 100% resistant population in Benin, they all contain this mutation. But in Cameroon, only the resistant mosquitoes contain this mutation, and the susceptible ones didn't contain the mutation.
Yes.
And so you also confirm this in other parts of Africa?
Yeah, we checked that also in Southern Africa, and they don't have the mutation in the susceptible population of Southern Africa.
Interesting. And then why does just this one mutation cause such high resistance?
Well, when we analyzed the structure of the protein with the mutation, we found changes in the shape and size of the binding site that allows to DDT fits in a close to reactive conformation, ensuring an optimal positioning for its catalysis. And it's only because of this mutation, so only one amino acid chain can modify the structure and the binding pocket and make it like a better binding pocket for DDT.
Interesting. But because this is metabolic resistance, could other genes also be involved in metabolizing the insecticide?
Yes, of course. But in our paper, using transgenics model organisms, Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly, we showed that the overexpression of GSTD2 alone can confer resistance. So this implies that GSTD2 is key by its own in DDT resistance in Western Africa.
Interesting. So it's a pretty important mutation. And because you're seeing this mutation varies in different locations in Africa, could this mutation be used as a molecular marker to track resistance?
Yes, absolutely yes. Finding this important mutation, GSTD2, implies that we have found a resistant marker that it can be used to easily detect and map the distribution of DDT resistant of Anopheles funestus across Africa. And it is the first time for a metabolic resistant marker in any malaria vector.
If you would like to read more about this, you can visit the paper in Genome Biology. It's entitled "A Single Mutation in the GSTD2 Gene Allows Tracking of Metabolically Based Insecticide Resistance in a Major Malaria Vector." Or you can visit Jacob Riverone's staff profile at the LSTM website. Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks to you, Kayla. It was a pleasure.
Thank you to Kayla and Dr. Riverone for the interview. Well, that's all for this month. Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the interviews and will join us again for the May podcast, brought to you by the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.